The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 201, a devotional session entitled Walking the Road to Emmaus with Francis Lee Menlove.
I'd like to welcome you to this morning's devotional. The number is 201, Walking the Road to Emmaus by Francis Lee Menlove. And before I introduce her, I just need to remind you to turn off your cell phones. Thank you. Frances Lee Menlove received her BA from Stanford, PhD from the University of Michigan in Psychology, and Master's of Divinity from Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. She was one of the founders of Dialogue, and she also notes that she was the first manuscript editor of Dialogue, author of Challenge of Honesty, appearing in the first volume. Frances has 4 children, 6 grandchildren, and she is retired from the University of California and lives in Depot Bay, Oregon. At the present time, she volunteers for the Red Cross. She leads a program of volunteers who visit and write and phone the elderly and shut-ins and the bereaved. She gives a Sunday afternoon church service at a local retirement home. Sister Menlove.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming out. It's hard to come out this early in the morning. This morning, we're going to take a look at that curious and haunting story of the encounter of the two disciples walking on the road to Emmaus. I was drawn to this story for personal reasons, but I'm going to get to that later. The story is found in Luke chapter 24, verses 13 to 35, and goes like this. Two of Jesus' disciples are walking dejectedly home from Jerusalem to the village of Emmaus. Their beloved Jesus has been crucified and died. They are talking with each other about all the things that had happened. While they are walking and discussing, Jesus himself comes near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. This is the way it spoke. And he said to them, quote, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know all the things that have taken place in these days?" Jesus asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over and condemned him to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." "Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since this took place." Then the stranger talked to them about the scriptures, interpreting them as he walked along. As they came near the village to which they were going, the stranger walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, stay with us, because it's almost evening and the day is nearly over. So he went in to stay with them, and when he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. When their eyes were opened and they recognized him, he vanished from their sight. They hurried back to Jerusalem, found the 11 companions together, and told them what had happened to them on the road to Emmaus, and how they had recognized Jesus as they broke bread together, and then how he vanished. There are so many questions with this story that it's hard to know where to begin. How can it be that two disciples could walk and talk with Jesus for several miles and not recognize him? How can it be that he explained the scriptures to them and they didn't know who he was? Also puzzling is the stranger's intention to continue on without stopping. Only when they urged him to stay did he stop. And it was only after they'd shown hospitality to the stranger that their eyes were opened. And then, as their eyes are opened, in that moment, that very moment, he disappears. Books and books are filled with commentaries on this odd story. But one day I heard John Dominic Crossan, a leading New Testament scholar, give a very cryptic and profound interpretation. "What do you make of the story of Cleopas on the road to Emmaus?" he was asked. "Oh," he replied without missing a beat, "the road to Emmaus never happened. The road to Emmaus happens every day." That was his answer. The road to Emmaus never happened. The road to Emmaus happens every day. Now, a map is going to show you that Emmaus is a town a few miles northwest of Jerusalem. And yet, the road to Emmaus is a road we've all walked down. Cleopas and his companion grappled with disappointment, defeat, and despair on their trek down the road to Emmaus. We've all traveled the same road. When the world is too much with us, when we despair at living a lukewarm existence, when we want to shut the door and forget that what we intended to do and what we did do don't match, forget that power is so often not on the side of justice, and forget that pain and death and sorrow are no respecters of age or innocence. Last December, I took a walk down the road to Emmaus. I was diagnosed with breast cancer. On my way home from the doctor's office that day, I decided to stop by the library to see if they had any books on breast cancer. I knew next to nothing, except, of course, dread. I found several books, and as I put them on the counter to check them out, the librarian said, "I remember when I was checking out these books." Then she paused, looked something up on her computer, wrote a note on a piece of paper, handed me the paper, and said, "You need this book too." Dutifully, I went back downstairs to the stacks, found the book, and returned it to check it out. I thanked her, and as I was turning to leave, she said, "You know, there is a sisterhood. There is a sisterhood. Yes, there is, and it has sustained me often on my walk down this Emmaus road, a road that has left me boobless and hairless and with a keen gratitude for sisterhood. I had seen that librarian several times before. She was no stranger. But that day she was the stranger I met on the road to Emmaus, the stranger who reflected the Spirit of Christ. A couple of years ago, I was helping out on a week-long day camp for children called Peace Village. The kids hear stories of peace heroes. They learn about nonviolent conflict resolution, crafts, go on hikes, play games. I was helping at the registration table, which was set up near the edge of the playground full of laughing, running, jumping, yelling kids. A father asked me to register his 7-year-old daughter, Kelly. Kelly was clinging to his leg, sobbing. "She wants to go home," he told me, "because she is the only one here wearing a dress. I've assured her that she can wear shorts or pants tomorrow. I think she will be okay for today," he added. After the registration was complete, one of the teen helpers took Kelly off to introduce her to her teacher. I spotted my 7-year-old granddaughter, Annika, and whispered to her that there was a new girl in her class who didn't know anyone and was upset because she was wearing a dress. "She needs a friend," I said as I pointed out Kelly in her green dress. That was Monday. On Friday, the last activity of Peace Village is the candle ceremony. The 40 kids, ages 6 to 13, sit on a floor in a large circle, each holding an unlit candle. One candle is lit, then one by one, each camper selects another camper who has been special to him or her for some reason during the week and lights their candle, saying something nice to them, such as, "Thank you for helping me on the hike. I had fun playing Foursquare with you. You make me laugh." Kelly, with her candle lit, walked purposely across the circle to Annika, lit her candle, and said, "You are the nicest person I have ever known." Kelly met a special stranger on her walk down the Emmaus Road, a stranger who reflected Jesus' light. On this road that happens every day, sometimes we are the disciple, and sometimes we are the stranger. Rabbi Kushner tells this story about his students, Great Aunt Susie. One snowy afternoon in Nazi Germany, she was riding home from work on the bus. The SS stormtroopers stopped the bus and began to examine papers of identification, systematically working their way down the aisle. Jews were told to leave the bus and go to a truck parked around the corner. Great Aunt Susie was near the back of the bus, and she began to cry and to tremble. The man next to her asked if she was all right. She said, "I am a Jew. They are going to take me." Suddenly, this man exploded with disgust. He began to curse and to scream at her. "You stupid woman," he roared. "I can't stand being near you." The SS man asked what was all the yelling about. "Damn her," the man shouted angrily. "I'm so fed up. She always does this. My wife has forgotten her papers again." The soldiers laughed and moved on, and Great Aunt Susie and the man got off the bus together. Great Aunt Susie never saw that man again. Great Aunt Susie never learned the name of that stranger who saved her. But this story is told and retold in her family. Another stranger met, another stranger reflecting God's light. Sometimes we are the stranger, and sometimes we are the disciple. Knowing that the road to Emmaus happens every day, Teresa of Avila, the 16th century mystic, tells us bluntly what we are to do. These are her words. This is what she tells us. "Christ has no body now on earth but yours. No hands but yours, no feet but yours. Yours are the eyes through which the compassion of Christ is to look out on a hurting world. Yours are the feet with which he is to go about doing good. Yours are the hands with which he is to bless now." Now, sometimes the road to Emmaus is in cyberspace. Bob Reese, in his essay, Personal Reflections on Homosexuality, recounts exchanges via email with gay Mormons. As you read these outpourings, you understand why Reese calls this a dark time as far as our understanding of homosexuality is concerned. It is also clear that Bob is walking side by side on this road to Emmaus with his gay brothers. "I am concerned about your depression," he writes to one. "Your worth to your Heavenly Father is inestimable, and you must not forget that. I will be your friend, whatever you decide to do, and I will be happy to talk to you as you work things out." Bob is right. There is a darkness today that we cannot ignore. Our lesbian and gay sisters and brothers are carrying the burden of growing social and legal hostility in this country. Laws are being proposed and sometimes passed, denying their fitness as parents, rejecting the value of their relationships. For example, there is a law under consideration in Alabama to forbid libraries and schools from buying books by gay authors or with gay characters. Tennessee Williams, William Faulkner, The Color Purple. Wow. Gary M. Watts is a medical doctor, a Mormon, a husband, and the father of a gay son. At the 1996 symposium, what's that, about 9 years ago, Brother Watts asked these two things of his Sunstone audience. First, he urged, "Get comfortable with the concept that homosexuals are just as capable of moral relationships as are heterosexuals. And second, be willing to articulate that position publicly." He goes on, "Too many of our good church members stand by and watch the hurt and anguish inflicted on our gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered brothers and sisters, and on us, their parents and friends, by unthinking, insensitive, uninformed individuals. Too many declare for themselves an ethical exemption and simply decide not to get involved. He is asking us to say no to the silence. He is asking us not to let our conscience look away or fall asleep. He is asking us to walk with them on the road to Emmaus. They don't want tolerance," Brother Watts continues. "They don't want tolerance because they are victims. They see themselves rightly as rational, moral individuals with a right to love whomever they will. And they have arrived appropriately at a position that the morality of relationships is based on the way the relationships are conducted, not on who is involved in them. Let us offer them radical inclusion in the full life of our church communities, without demanding they become who they are not, without the barriers of a willingness to change or a guilt-laden celibacy as the price of admission. We cannot look the other way. There's too much at stake. Remember, we are talking about an intolerance which leads to broken lives, lives lived out in fear and secrets, families sundered, and even suicide. Can we see Jesus in our lesbian sisters and our gay brothers? Can we act in such a way that they can see Jesus in us? If we look around us, among the members of this family, this household of God, our lesbian sisters and gay brothers, they can be our teachers, offering us lessons of the heart. They can walk with patience and faith and with hearts made deep by pain. Let's walk along with them. Let us learn from them. The road to Emmaus happens every day. Sunstone gatherings are promising places for disciples walking the roads with steps weighted by grief or despair to encounter strangers. The Sunstone Fellowship is a place of refuge, of joy in being listened to, and excitement in meeting new people and new ideas. Now, before you head out for an animating day of Sunstone sessions, listen again to the exhortation of Teresa of Avila. I will then conclude with a few words to live by. This is Teresa. "Christ has no body now on earth but yours, no hands but yours, no feet but yours. Yours are the eyes through which the compassion of Christ is to look out on a hurting world. Yours are the feet with which he is to go about doing good. Yours are the hands with which he is to bless now." Now I'll close with the words to live by. Life is short, and we have not much time for gladdening the hearts of those who travel the way with us. Oh, be swift to love. Make haste to be kind. The road to Emmaus happens every day. The road to Emmaus runs through sunstones. Sometimes we are the disciples. Sometimes we are the stranger. Thank you for coming.